Support for this On the Media podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more, across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. More at audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in Libya, the regime of Muammar Gaddafi continues what seems to be an inevitable slide into the dustbin of history. On Monday, Libyan rebels confidently sent out a mass text reading in part, "We congratulate the Libyan people for the fall of Muammar Gaddafi."
We're hearing reports that two of Muammar Gaddafi's sons have been arrested by the rebels, including Saif al-Islam.
But on Tuesday, Saif al-Islam was clearly free. New York Times Cairo bureau chief David Kirkpatrick is in Tripoli, where he says information and misinformation commingle freely. For instance, when journalists were held captive at a hotel in the city, the standoff ended with a sudden change in allegiances when some journalists gave the Gaddafi loyalists guarding the reporters the gift of truth.
Later that day, a couple of Arabic language fluent journalists sat down with him and said, "Look around you. The big guys have all left. They've left you here alone. How much longer do you think you can take this?" And according to several journalists who were there, the chief guard around that point broke down in tears. They surrendered their weapons not to the rebels, but to the journalists.
We reached Kirkpatrick on Thursday at his hotel as fighters ran by outside his window and reporters battled for clarity.
Libya is a unique opportunity for propaganda because the Gaddafi regime maintains such an information vacuum. That is, no independent press, people afraid to talk candidly on the phone, so many street informants that it's dangerous to even talk candidly on the street or in cafes. In that atmosphere, there's a real opportunity for other parties to throw up their own stories. Anybody can say anything.
In your piece, you say that the rebels have offered their own far-fetched claims, like mass rapes by loyalist troops issued tablets of Viagra.
That is definitely one of the most lurid bits of propaganda to come out of this. I don't think there has ever been any evidence of systematic or mass rapes by either side in this conflict. And I heard those claims being repeated at very high levels by the West. And what that goes to show is that even NATO is not immune to indulging in a little bit of propaganda. You know, they have an uncorroborated and slightly outlandish report, but they'll grab it if it helps to drum up support at home and among the Libyan people for their cause, the cause of the rebels.
One notorious example was the capture or maybe non-capture of one of Gaddafi's sons, Saif al-Islam. The rebels claimed they'd captured him, but after that he made a public appearance claiming that his father's government was still in control. Did that shake the confidence of Libyans in the reliability of the rebels?
I know it led to some finger-pointing within the rebel leadership. And to me, what's most amusing is the public explanation that one of their top officials made in a press conference in Doha. He said, "Well, this was sort of a misunderstanding. We tried to tell the International Criminal Court we had an unconfirmed rumor that he was captured. They mistakenly said that we had told them he was captured. But then you know what? It worked out okay for us because this report led to some good news. We had recognition from more countries, more embassies defecting to our side, and many commanders turned over. So we thought, well, let's let it go." It was the closest thing I've ever heard to a propagandist justifying a mistruth because it was good propaganda.
What's it take to file accurate reports with all the lying on all sides?
Well, it's very difficult to file accurate reports because it's block by block as far as safety. So we wake up every day with an ambitious agenda of stories we'd like to pursue. And to a significant extent, what we end up writing about is what we can reach. We only see the trunk and not the whole elephant.
For some days, it certainly seemed as if the victory of the rebels was inevitable and that it still is. But, you know, you hear Wolf Blitzer saying, "Oh, it could go this way, it could go that way," depending on what's going on in a particular block in Tripoli at a given time. And I wonder if the need for novelty in rolling news reports can lead people to make too much of an incident that doesn't deserve it.
I think there is intrinsic in the nature of 24-hour cable news insatiable appetite to make a big deal out of a little deal. That said, this particular situation, I think, is vexing for them and for us because, you know, we reported the rebels have taken Tripoli, and it really looked like the rebels had taken Tripoli. And then the next day, we tried to venture out of our hotels, and we found, you know what? It's not safe at all. The rebels don't really control Tripoli, and neither does Gaddafi. And since then, it's been a little bit of a seesaw. And so while intellectually we'd like to be moving on to the next stage, you know, okay, who are the rebels? Are they going to abide by these promises of inclusivity and civility and democracy? We keep getting pulled back into, hold it, do they have the neighborhood around our hotel?
In your piece, you quoted Rob Crilly of the Daily Telegraph of London, who wrote on Tuesday this week, "Twitter and 24-hour rolling news channels and sat phones are still useless against the fog of war." There were criticisms of the coverage of the American Civil War in the wake of the brand new technology of the telegraph that the reporters had declared Atlanta won for the North 2 weeks before the Northern Army got there.
Well, that's right. The other night, I was talking to a gentleman who lives right off of the central square here in Tripoli. And he said that Saturday night, the night that Tripoli really rose up, he had watched the Gaddafi forces massing in Green Square because they knew the rebels were coming. They knew people were going to rise up and come to Green Square. He's sitting at home in his apartment around the corner, this gentleman, and he's watching Al Jazeera. And Al Jazeera says, "The rebels are here. They're in Green Square." So he rushes out to the street. No rebels. Apparently, had tipped off Al Jazeera that they were coordinating their movements. They expected to be in Green Square, and Al Jazeera went with it. Moments later, sure enough, the rebels show up from four different directions. And a half an hour after that, the Gaddafi troops have evaporated, says this witness. And it's a remarkable episode because it shows you the sophistication that the rebels have about using the media to their advantage.
If Al Jazeera doesn't see it, then it didn't happen.
That's very true in this part of the world.
Thank you very much.
Okay, talk to you soon.
David Kirkpatrick is the New York Times Cairo bureau chief. The Libyan media have a lot to learn after four decades of service to the Gaddafi regime. Jamal Dajani is vice president of Middle East and North Africa at Internews, which just released an assessment of Libyan media. Jamal, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So your report examines Libyan media's past, present, and future. So start with the past.
During the reign of Muammar Gaddafi, Libya has rated as one of the least free countries in the Arab region. There was no such a thing as freedom of expression or a free media.
Tunisia and Egyptian media were also notorious for censorship, but you say that they were very different cases, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you cannot compare the media in Libya to a country like Egypt, where you had universities, broadcast schools. So even though you had censorship under the Mubarak regime and in Tunisia under Ben Ali, there was a little bit of wiggle room. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example, had its own media. Other opposition groups had their own media outlets, even though there were crackdowns. Under Gaddafi, this was non-existent. To be a journalist was a very dangerous profession, even when you worked for the regime itself, because you never knew when you would cross the red lines. I mean, I've known a journalist who was put in jail for 3 years because he showed up to a press conference 15 minutes late.
3 years?
Gaddafi decided to change the venue to another location where he flew by helicopter, which takes about 90 minutes to get to the new venue. And this reporter made it 15 minutes late. Not only he lost his job, but he was sentenced to 3 years.
And Gaddafi, he was determined to create year one in Libya. New flag, new national anthem, changing the name of the country. And then as he proceeded, he didn't want the names of government officials or of sports stars to be cited in the press. Football stars could only be referred to by their numbers and government officials by their titles.
It's really not to outshine him. He did not want people to become more famous or their names to make it in the media. So if you were a superstar, you know, that was too much for him. And there were so many fine lines in the way the media portrayed Gaddafi, including his many names. You know, at times he was Colonel Gaddafi, and then later on he wanted to be addressed by everyone as brother leader. Statements he made had to be quoted in a certain way. If a reporter would have made a mistake, there were severe and harsh punishments.
Okay, so in February of this year, the uprisings begin. We start to see a proliferation of free media in parts of the country that aren't controlled by Gaddafi. Tell me a little bit about the media that started popping up.
Right. You had, by July, some 120 publications, 5 radio stations, 3 to 5 TV stations. You have Libyans living in diaspora. You have doctors, you have engineers, you have students. And they all decided to return and to start forming their own outlets.
And they all started with this one goal, which was the downfall of Gaddafi. So what happens to revolutionary media when the revolution's over?
Well, that's the big question. The good news is Libya is almost a virgin territory for media because Gaddafi left nothing there for anyone to build on. Unlike Egypt, I mean, Egypt, we've seen the changes, but at the end of the day, we've seen a reshuffling of the seats. So many of those who used to pay homage to Mubarak all of a sudden changed their tune like 180 degrees overnight and started to praise the revolution. In Libya, you have people who came from outside. You have also the young people who would have never dreamt to become a reporter or a producer because they knew the price. And now you can train a new energetic cadre of journalists and have the opportunity to lay the foundation for a free media.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Jamal Dajani is Vice President of Middle East and North Africa for the Internews Network. Here's a taste of Gaddafi's infamous We Will Hunt You speech remixed, a viral sensation. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Gaddafi regime and its media machine may be on its way out, but the revolution in Libya is still at a very early stage. So we decided to check in with the state of the media in Egypt, now in the later stage of its revolution, to see how the media fared after all the revolutionary avowals of press freedom. Khalid Daoud is a reporter for the leading Egyptian newspaper Al-Ahram. We met him first in April when we visited the offices of Al-Ahram. What's your beat here?
I cover regional affairs and I also cover the local political scene.
What's going to happen the first time you push against the red line?
My article won't get published.
Khalid, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you, Brooke.
So back in April, the newly free Egyptian media was finding its footing amid public suspicion that the same news outlets that never questioned Mubarak were now happy to condemn him. What about now?
Things remain unstable within the Egyptian media as well as in the country in general. The Egyptian armed forces recently has started referring a few activists, bloggers, and even freelance journalists to military trials after writing some critical views and opinions about the military itself.
So what we knew was going to be the greatest area of difficulty for reporters back in April turned out to be the case, and that is reporting on the excesses and abuses of the military. Some said that it wasn't the right time, that reporters shouldn't attack the only stable institution left after the revolution. What about among the people? Do they want the press to report freely on the military council now in charge?
Definitely. I think people expect more transparency since we had our revolution more than 7 months ago, because that was one of the major problems about the previous regime, which is the lack of transparency. Our future is not as certain as we thought it would be. Nobody knows when the presidential elections will be held. A lot of people, Egyptians, are not happy about the issue of referring civilians to military trials. And especially people became more concerned recently after we saw one young activist who was referred to a military court simply because of a tweet in which he was very critical of the military forces. And everybody said at that time that even the former regime wouldn't refer people to military trials because of a tweet or because of some stuff she wrote on her Facebook page.
It sounds like what you're saying is things are less free than they were back in April.
I wouldn't go that far, but definitely the military council proved to be impatient with the criticism and, you know, within all the problems that we're having, lack of security, economic problems. We really wonder why is the military people taking the time to look into every single Facebook page or a tweet by activists instead of working on solving the problems of the country itself.
Are there many cases of journalists or people on Twitter or people who maintain blogs awaiting military tribunals or having been tossed into the clink?
Well, there were a few cases over the past few months, but it's ups and downs. Like right now, or the past, say, 10 days after the death of the Egyptian soldiers on the border with Israel, this issue basically topped the agenda right now. And young Egyptians, the same one who were demanding stop for the military trials, are now demonstrating in support of the army and angry because of the death of the Egyptian soldiers. So we found that the army gave in compromises and decided not to try several people. But nobody knows how they will act a week from now or 2 weeks from now.
So I asked you a few months ago what would happen when you tried to cross those red lines. And you said with a high degree of confidence that Al-Ahram wouldn't let you do it.
Well, Al-Ahram would still not let me do it. But right now, probably I also have to think about the issue of a military trial.
So what advice would you give to journalists in Libya right now?
They'll find that the post-dictatorship period is not as easy as they might have hoped or aspired to. And they have to prepare themselves for an open society in which everything will be under observation, in which everything would be open for criticism, and to be tolerant of that. And I also ask my fellow journalists to be responsible towards our readers and to learn how to shift allegiance from a person or a regime to the people whom they should have always had loyalty to, are their readers in the first place.
Khalid, thank you so much.
No problem. You're most welcome. It's my pleasure.
Khalid Daoud covers regional affairs for the Egyptian newspaper Al-Ahram. No crimes excite public disgust like sex crimes. But according to two recent studies, the laws we create to deter sex offenders from relapsing after they serve time may be doing more harm than good. The first study looked at a law that exists in some form in every state, registry laws, where sex offenders must tell local police their address. The second study looked at notification laws. Think of Megan's Law, passed in response to high-profile crimes committed by sex offenders after they've served their terms. Such laws require that not just the police, but communities are informed when a convicted sex offender is in their midst. Amanda Agin, a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago, worked on one of the studies I just mentioned. She found that registering with the police had no impact on whether sex offenders committed further crimes. We wondered why.
One possibility is it may in some sense decrease what we would call the opportunity cost of committing a crime. So once you're on the registry, studies by psychologists have found that sex offenders have harder time getting jobs, they have harder times making friends, residency restrictions may make it hard for them to find a place to live. They are somewhat more isolated from society, and that may make it so, you know, if they're thinking about committing a crime, the cost that we may think of, the cost that we may lose our job, that we may lose the ties to our families, those costs don't exist for them anymore. They have less to lose, and that's one possibility. I mean, I would say that we don't know very well exactly why they're not working right now.
Does that suggest to you that we shouldn't have them?
I think that's also a great question. I mean, these registries are costing millions of dollars to implement. And it looks like across several studies, they've been found to be ineffective at increasing public safety. However, we're probably going to be hard-pressed to find a politician who's willing to support repealing these laws. And in that case, I think we might want to think about whether we can implement different policies or procedures that may make them more effective.
Like what?
states have some flexibility in how they implement the registries. So some states register people for 10 years, some states register them for 15, some states register them for life. Some states only put the most violent criminals on their internet registry notifications, and some states put all registered sex offenders on their internet notification. And as far as I know, nobody's looked at how these different policies can affect the effectiveness of the registries. And in that sense, we may want to allow the states even more flexibility so that if we were to keep them, we can find the optimal mix of policies so that when we implement them, they are at least somewhat effective.
Have you ever wondered why we have a registry for people convicted of sex crimes but not people convicted of homicide? Is it just that sex crimes are more icky?
I think people find sex crimes to be particularly heinous, to quote Law & Order SVU. I think also with homicide, if somebody is caught and convicted of homicide, they're very likely to be in jail for life, whereas sex offenders are not going to jail for life. They're going to be back on the streets, and there was these large particular crimes that received a lot of national media attention that caused each of these changes in the laws. I mean, the laws themselves are named after the children who were victims.
For us, the interesting question is, does violating the privacy of an ex-con, a convicted sex offender, mm-hmm. protect society at all?
It seems like, if anything, it could make things worse. So when the registries were first implemented, they were only for use by police. The sex offenders had to go to the local police station or some sort of local law enforcement agency and let them know where they were currently living. With the advent of Megan's Law, states had to start public notification about the information on the registry. Most states, and in fact, I believe now all states, handle this via the internet. So you can go to your state's sex offender registry website and find the addresses of all the registered sex offenders. Or in particular, you can look for your own address in there and see, say, all of the sex offenders that live within a mile. So there were definitely two policies, registration and public notification. I was looking particularly at the registration policy because I had data from the 1990s. So that was before internet and community notification had begun. The other study by J.J. Prescott and Jonah Rockoff, they looked particularly at what happens to first-time registrants versus those on the registry already once public notification begins.
So once it was just the police who knew where they were, and it seemed to have no impact on whether or not they would begin to engage in criminal behavior again. Now we're talking about a situation in which the public has free access to the same information.
Right.
And what did that study find?
They seemed to find a slight increase in how much they recidivated, although they did find a slight deterrent effect for first-time offenders. But as the registry size grows, it seems like that recidivism effect swamps the first-time registrant effect, and so we get kind of an overall increase in sex crime.
And you think it's for the same reason that with the further incursion into their privacy, they end up more and more isolated and have less and less to lose?
You know, we don't have concrete evidence about that, but I think that that's going to be part of what's going on.
All right. Thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Amanda Agin is a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago. In 1993, the mutilated bodies of three second graders were found behind a truck stop in West Memphis, Arkansas. Three teenage boys, Damian Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly, were soon prosecuted for the murders. Two were sentenced to life in prison, and Damian Eccles was sentenced to death. Their trials in the court and the media painted the suspects as Satanists, focusing on Damian Eccles, the most vocal of the trio, who listened to heavy metal and dabbled in Wicca.
Reverend Tommy Stacy's church is down the street from where the bodies were found. 1 year ago, Damian Eccles told the church his youth minister, he had a pact with the devil and he was going to hell.
In the ensuing years, the investigation was criticized, testimony was recanted, and the jury was accused of misconduct. Last week, after 18 years behind bars, the prisoners known as the West Memphis Three entered an unconventional plea bargain arrangement called an Alford plea, in which they pled guilty while maintaining their innocence. They were released. The case was one of the last gasps of the satanic panic, a kind of national hysteria that Satanists, using subversive literature and heavy metal music, among other things, were turning kids into killers and cannibals. Geraldo Rivera's 1988 special report, Exposing Satan's Underground, offered a handy list of clues that your child might be crossing over to the dark side.
Parents, warning signs that might indicate a child's drift toward Satanism include abrupt emotional changes, changes in school habits, rejection of parental values, unusual interest in books on Satanism, black magic, or witchcraft, obsession with rock music groups using satanic symbols or references, rejection of friends, preference for being alone, meditation, chanting, use of new vocabulary.
Mara Leverett, author of a book about the case called The Devil's Knot, said that the FBI had thoroughly investigated and debunked most of the claims made during the satanic panic of the late 80s. But in West Memphis, Arkansas, in 1993, the fear was still very much alive.
In West Memphis, I know that there were people who were already concerned about signs like pentagram graffiti in town, and the preachers were talking about how children were being drawn into the occult by Ouija boards. There was a lot of that still lingering in a fairly conservative part of Arkansas near the Mississippi River on the east side of the state. Then come these three murders, and from there on, it was a wild ride.
Talk to me about how the satanic angle was played up by the media.
It was reported that Damien Eccles had a cat skull in his bedroom. He wore black.
There seemed to be a lot of emphasis on the wearing of black. I mean, I know I would have been dragged in for questioning.
Yes, the wearing of black, as Jason Baldwin told me later from prison, we were wearing concert t-shirts, a lot of concert t-shirts that Jason had gotten when he'd attended them with his mother, and of heavy metal bands. And this was an area where some church leaders were inviting their young people in their congregations to burn recordings from these types of bands because the music itself was considered satanic. And so when the police searched Jason Baldwin's home, they took out 11 black t-shirts, and that information was introduced at his trial.
But just as the media seemed to be pushing the satanic component of this case when it was being prosecuted, other parts of the media kept interest in the case alive and raised questions well after they were in jail.
That's exactly right. A producer at HBO noted a 3 or 4 inch report on this case right after the arrests in June of 1993, and passed it on to the team of filmmakers, Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky. They immediately came to West Memphis, and they have since told me, with the idea that they were going to be making a film about crazed satanic teenagers killing three boys. And Berlinger and Sanofsky got a complete video recording of the two trials that were held. And in 1996, they released their film, Paradise Lost. And they did a spectacular job of editing very lengthy trials into a very fair and accurate documentary. And it was highly criticized by attorneys for the men in prison by the time it came out, who said their own attorneys should not have let the defendants participate in the film. I know the judge deeply regrets having allowed that film to be made, and the prosecutors probably do too.
Damien Eccles credits Paradise Lost with essentially saving his life.
I really do believe without that footage of the trials, the state would have probably already killed me by now.
After that movie came out, a group of people in Los Angeles who happened to work in the film industry started a website called WM3.org right when the internet was taking off. And that site became an archive of every bit of information in the case. People flocked to it. From there, it was Facebook. Celebrities became involved. Millions of dollars was raised for new investigations. And it was not until a year ago, in August, Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam and Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks and Patti Smith and Johnny Depp came to Little Rock for a huge concert attended by 4,000 people. I think when the powers that be in this state saw that, they realized that the tide had turned in Arkansas. When the prosecuting attorney at the original trials was defeated in his run for the Arkansas Supreme Court, in large part because of his role in these prosecutions, that also had everybody sit up and take notice. And it was soon after that that the Arkansas Supreme Court ordered the new hearing on this case that ultimately resulted in what happened last week.
What does this say about the role of media in American justice? Do you need celebrities?
Well, I would say that your representation needs also to have a media representative. And there was one in this case. Lonnie Sori of New York was brought in to help with media management. And media was so key, was so essential, and strategizing. And even at that, it took 18 years.
Mara, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Mara Leverett is a journalist and author of the book, The Devil's Knot, about the West Memphis Three, about to become a feature film. Coming up, you can't judge a president by his book covers. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
Support for this On the Media podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more, with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Audible suggests that On the Media listeners might enjoy I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee 59, Ben Mezrich's Sex on the Moon, or John Hart's Iron House. To learn more about Audible and get a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
This is On the Media, and I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. Last week, we spoke with Bay Area Rapid Transit Deputy Police Chief Daniel Hartwig. When faced with a large demonstration on a subway platform, his department decided to cut off some cell phone service to prevent protesters from communicating. Here's a clip of Hartwig explaining his actions to Bob.
Obviously, there is maintaining the public safety and order. And then there is suppressing political protest and freedom of speech. Can the police department be trusted to make the decision when it is the former and not the latter?
We never lead with suppression of social media, suppression of First Amendment rights, suppression in any manner.
There's a nasty hidden message to the statement, wrote listener Hunter J.E. from Kirkland, Washington. He went on, quote, first, it says that they too consider what they're doing to be suppressing First Amendment rights, and second, that they consider that a perfectly valid tool, if not a first one. What we have is a government-run institution saying right out that it considers impinging on the constitutional rights of citizens something it does and a valid tool. Disturbing. The counterargument came from Rena in Philadelphia, where there have been incidents of social media-fueled violence recently. She wrote that, quote, I doubt many residents of Philly would have had any problem with blocking social media. For that story, we also spoke to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Jillian York, who drew comparisons between the BART shutdown and Egypt's Hosni Mubarak shutting down the internet at key moments during the uprising there. Here's a clip from that interview.
Does it help when police trying to do their best are compared to tyrants?
I do think that these are two different situations, but at the same time, the actions of the BART police did very much reflect the actions of Mubarak earlier this year in shutting down this media. While these things did happen on very different scales, the intent was the same, to shut down speech in light of protests. We are looking at this as precedent, as a slippery slope, and I do fear that this is something we're going to be seeing a lot more often.
I believe that Gillian York overreaches with her slippery slope argument in this particular instance, wrote Phil Edwards from Richmond, Virginia. He added, quote, I hardly think that the limited geographic scope of the actions, along with the rationale provided by law enforcement, should evoke the same level of outrage as those of a regime which compels ISPs within its borders to choke off networked access for the entire nation state. But reasonable people may disagree with this, and isn't that kind of the point? All of the comments I just quoted from came from our website, which, as you may or may not know, recently underwent a facelift. Now you can get an OTM fix all week long. You just go to onthemedia.org, where you can find our new blog, occasional puzzles, and regular features, such as our staff picks. This summer, I found myself on two separate weeks recommending novels about werewolves. What does that say about me? And that brings us neatly to our next story. Every summer, the White House releases what the president will be reading on his vacation. Usually, the lists are full of weighty tomes of political theory or history. President Bush's 2006 summer reading list of 13 books included biographies of Abraham Lincoln, A History of Polio, Camus' The Stranger, and Shakespeare's Macbeth. Earlier this week, the White House released President Obama's summer reading. Of the five books cited, four were fiction. This has set off grumbling amongst some Republican pundits, saying that by reading fiction, Obama looked like a political lightweight. Tevi Troy, writing in the National Review Online, said that, quote, the near absence of nonfiction sends the wrong message for any president because it sets him up for the charge that he is out of touch with reality. Theodore Roosevelt is often invoked by Republicans as a paragon of firmly grounded, pragmatic participation on the public stage.
I know that many of you have noticed it's not my style to simply phone it in.
John McCain said, I believe our leaders belong in the arena.
I'm a Teddy Roosevelt Republican.
John Huntsman said, I'm a center-right candidate.
I think I've got pragmatic and practical solutions. If you don't step up and do what Teddy Roosevelt would have advocated, get in the arena, it says something about you.
But even while Teddy Roosevelt himself was in the arena, he was reading everything from science to history to fiction to poetry. We called Edmund Morris, author of The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, Theodore Rex, and Colonel Roosevelt, to ask him about the reading habits of the 26th president.
Well, when you talk about these rather pathetic little lists that presidents feel they have to announce every summer, there's a list that TR was asked to compile by the president of Columbia University in 1903. And TR's list extends for three closely printed pages of his collected letters. He wrote that he'd read parts of Herodotus, all of Polybius, a little of Plutarch, Sophocles 7 against Thebes, Euripides, Hippolytus, and Bacchae. Later on, we've got Carlyle. We've got a whole raft, something like half a page of novels, including all of Walter Scott. He was reading, by the way, in German and Italian and French, as well as in English. He was omnivorous. He read, on average, a book a day. That's not an exaggeration. It's documented. Sometimes he read three books a day.
Where did he get the time?
I don't know. He was just an extraordinarily fast reader, about 3 to 4 pages a minute. And everything he read, he tended to photograph in his head. So he remembered everything. He could quote stuff years, decades later, word perfect.
But obviously, if he's spending his time reading Walter Scott, I mean, he must have been a very lightweight president. And in fact, he can't have been engaged in anything serious on the public stage.
Well, I can't think of anything more irritating than the claim that to read fiction is to be lightweight. On the contrary, I think somebody who reads nothing but political books and books on contemporary affairs, which is the average diet of all these political drones who've been criticizing President Obama, I think they are lightweights. A man who can read good poetry and good fiction is by nature a rounded man and a man with a rich mind.
There were people who wanted to claim the president based on his reading. The poet Robert Frost said, "He was our kind." He quoted poetry to me.
He flabbergasted Frost when he met him in 1907 and recited one of Frost's least well-known poems to him entire. And more relevantly, Edward Arlington Robinson, who's completely forgotten now but was a great poet, a contemporary of Frost, T.R. read this man's poems in 1905, heard that he was on the skids in New York City working in the subway system, and gave him a federal job on the strict understanding that he should do nothing but write poetry as long as T.R. remained president. And Edward Arlington Robinson went on to win 3 Pulitzer Prizes.
Let me ask you about moments of national crisis. Did you notice any drop-off or change in his reading during moments of great political pressure?
No, the way T.R. reacted to pressure was to luxuriate in it. He loved pressure, and the greater the pressure, the better he functioned.
If Teddy Roosevelt read so broadly in so many different genres, is it possible to offer a psychological portrait of him based on his reading?
I'll only say that a president who reads widely and reads as voraciously as this begins to, and if he reads in other languages, he gets to understand foreign cultures, which is a prerequisite of the presidency that has been really shortchanged over the last century or so.
How many books did he write?
He wrote approximately 40 books, and they comprised in part multi-volume histories of the American West, a whole series of biographies, and lots of stuff on naval history and military history and nature and hunting and a plethora of other subjects.
How many did he write when he was president?
He did not write any books as president, with the exception of editing a book on wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
But he felt that the president of the United States should concentrate on being president.
And reading.
Yeah, on reading.
Edmund Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun.
Edmund Morris has written the definitive trilogy of books about President Theodore Roosevelt, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, Theodore Rex, and Colonel Roosevelt.
I am not leading this fight as a matter of aesthetic pleasure. I am leading because somebody must lead, or else the fight would not be made at all. I prefer to work with moderate, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward toward the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them.
Artists like the Doobie Brothers, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, the Village People, you know, musicians of a certain age, are counting the minutes to January 2013. In 1976, Congress revised copyright law, inserting a provision that allows musicians and songwriters to regain control of work initially registered with the Copyright Office after January 1, 1978. The only catch? The artists had to wait 35 years. Now, the rights to the hits and flops of 1978 are poised to revert to the artists. For them, it will mean a windfall. And not surprisingly, says Duke University law professor James Boyle, the major record labels are girding for war. James, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here.
So is the law really clear on this matter?
The law is not clear. This is something that copyright lawyers just love to argue about. It has a Talmudic complexity. But basically, the situation is this. The law was changed so that if you assigned your copyright to someone, a publisher, a film studio, a record company, after 35 years, you could get it back. Hopefully, at that point, you could unspool the deal that you made in your youthful enthusiasm and perhaps reap the benefits of whatever success your works had achieved in the meantime.
You could get it back.
You could get it back.
That reminds me of a song of 1978.
Reunited, and it feels so good. Reunited.
With all the great songs from 1978, surely we could have done better than Peaches and Herb. But the law doesn't apply to so-called works for hire. So if Microsoft hires a programmer to improve Microsoft Word's help features, nobody thinks that he gets to be the copyrighted owner of Microsoft Word. Microsoft will own the copyright, not him. And so the record companies would like to say that the people who make albums, whether it's Don Henley and the Eagles or whether it's the B-52s or Blondie or the Police, all people had great songs from 1978, that those people are just workers for hire. They were assigned by the record studios to create the music that they made.
I hate to say it, but that reminds me of another song.
Now, if that were true, then the record companies are correct. The rights don't get terminated. They keep the copyrights over these sound recordings. But here's the first lovely irony of this tale. As you may know, recording contracts are vicious, nasty things that resemble feudal indenture. They basically make the artist bear all of the costs of the recording, everything from the sound recording costs to the costs of hiring session musicians to the promotion, the payola, the shipping. All of these things come out of the artist's share of royalties, and the artist will never manage to recoup their original advance until they paid off this whole cost. Does that sound to you like an employee, a worker for hire? No, it doesn't. So the wonderful thing here is that the recording companies are actually in a terrible rhetorical position because of the very overreaching contracts that they have imposed on their own artists. It's just a delicious irony.
Do you want to pick a song to suggest that?
I think the position of the record companies comes from one of my favorite songs of 1978.
So you're not terribly sympathetic to the major labels' arguments, but since they're not making much cash on new songs, they're increasingly relying on cash from the old ones. They're really going to miss it.
First of all, it's fair to say that there are arguments on the other side. The danger in this whole change, in this whole legal debate, and the danger that the record companies have actually focused on is, what if this produces a fragmentation of rights? What if there are copyright claims not just from the rock musicians, but from the backup singers, from the recording engineer, the sound engineer? All of these people have played a role in the creation of the record. Could they all claim copyrights in it? At that point, in order to get permission to play the music, would you have to strike a deal independently with 10 or 12 people? That's called a rights thicket, and it's something that lawyers try to avoid. I think, frankly, that prospect is overblown. I don't think the courts would do that. I think they'd draw a line under the artist and probably say that the backup singers don't get a share of the copyright. But it's one that the record companies have been stressing and saying the copyright should stay safe and they should stay with us.
Major labels have always made the argument that a few big releases pay for all the modestly selling experiments they might do. It's essentially the same argument made by pharmaceutical companies. You know, you put in a lot of R&D, but maybe only one drug is a big hit. Do you see any validity to that argument? If you deprive Sony of the profits from Kenny Rogers, will we see fewer sleeper bands that could one day be great?
It's a weak argument because they knew fine well, ever since the passage of the 1976 Copyright Act, that there was at least a great risk that these recordings would go back to the artists. That meant that they should have been pricing in those risks into the contracts they do, just as when you're, you know, buying Greek bonds, you're pricing in the risk of default. Secondly, of all the times to say that we need these huge windfalls on the established hits of the late 70s in order to fund our future music pipeline, I think this is one of the worst, because it was true back in 78 that you really needed access to recording studios, to the airwaves to a promotional network. You had to have distribution chains in order to get your music out there. And so the recording companies could legitimately say, without us, this music just won't make it to the consumer. That's a much harder argument to make now. And in fact, some recent empirical studies have shown that despite file sharing, despite all of the travails that the music industry is going through, there's a striking number of new artists who are being picked as the most creative in their fields by Pitchfork and other reviewing sites. It doesn't seem like the pipeline of new and creative musicians is slowing down, even though the record companies are claiming that their losses are at an all-time high.
So could you sum up this situation then with a song?
From the point of view of the record companies, I think that the ultimate answer is that, in the words of Gloria Gaynor, they will survive.
James, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
James Boyle is a professor of law at Duke University.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. So now you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second, you'd be back to bother me. Go on now, go. Walk down.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.